today the question is quite a central one. It's what's so special about Jesus? What is so special about Jesus? And why are we Christians so into Jesus? I mean, sure, we talk about God. Every culture wrestles with questions around God or gods. Why Jesus? Why is he such a big deal? And I want to just get straight into it and share a few of the reasons today that for some of us, you know, for some of us this is a reminder that we need, and for others this is brand new, but this is central business as Christians. Why are we so into Jesus out of anybody? First thing, nobody taught like him. Nobody taught like him. Throughout history, of course, there have been loads of moral teachers, religious teachers all over the world. Why is there so much fuss about Jesus in particular? In Matthew's Gospel, chapter 7, it's an account of Jesus' life. It has this summary of how his teaching went down. And it says this, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowd were amazed at his teaching, for he taught with real authority, quite unlike their teachers of religious law. In other words, people were blown away. They'd all heard other teachers. You couldn't move for spiritual teachers in first century Israel, but Jesus was different. It wasn't just that he said great things. It was this carrying of authority, this sense that someone is speaking and you think, wow, you know what you're talking about, don't you? It's never happened to me. But Jesus had that like nobody else, that sense of people, you just know what you're talking about. What was it, though, that Jesus had just said when Matthew wrote these words to summarize how people felt? You can look this up later, but this is a summary of this is at the end of what is called the Sermon on the Mount, which is just three short chapters of Jesus' teaching. It's sort of his manifesto for life. And what we have recorded is just a few hundred words. But in just this little section, Jesus talks about the perspectives on life that will lead you to flourish, how to use your influence on the world, what God really wants from humanity, how to deal with anger, why to avoid adultery, how to understand the seriousness of divorce, how to resist oppression without violence, why loving your enemies is good, how to give generously, how to pray, how to see your money and your possessions rightly, how to challenge people without being judgmental, how to summarize the ethics of the Old Testament, and then as an encore, he philosophizes about eternal life, explains how to identify what good teaching is, and then he finally identifies his own teaching as wise. In a few hundred words. Amazing. I mean, especially at the end, he identifies his own teaching as good. If anybody else did that, we'd say, well, that's really arrogant. But given that it's Jesus, and given that he's just blown everybody away with his teaching, you sort of think, well, fair enough. You can get away with saying that. But some of the ideas, even just in this sermon, this is just one bit of Jesus' teaching, some of the ideas are so influential in our world now that we just see them as obvious. We go, well, yeah, of course that's true. But it wasn't necessarily the case before Jesus said them. The fact that Jesus' words still stand up shows us that Jesus understood what people are like in any time and in any place in a way that nobody else ever has. It's all genius, everything he says. Just a quick example. Chapter 5, so this is during the sermon I just mentioned. He has this three-chapter sermon, just a few lines he says here. And he says this, if you are sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. Give to those who ask and don't turn away from those who want to borrow. Now, when you first read this with our 21st century eyes, it sounds like Jesus is saying, be a doormat. That's how you should be a good person, be a doormat. But there's more to it. You see, in those times, if you were sued in court and you ended up having to give up your shirt, that would have meant that you basically didn't have anything else to give. In other words, you would have had to have been poor. Your shirt was all you had left. And in all likelihood, it would be a rich person that was suing you. If then you gave them your coat as well, then the rich person would have to leave court, they'd have to, wearing the coat of a poor man. It would be embarrassing to him. He would look like a complete idiot. People would have laughed when Jesus said this. Israel was also under a Roman occupation at the time. And if a soldier asked a peasant to do something, he had no choice but to do it or he would get into lots of trouble. However, there was also a rule that a soldier could not ask a peasant to carry their pack more than 1 mile, or that soldier would get into big trouble with his commanding officer. So if a Jewish peasant carried the pack for a mile and then said, no, I'm fine, I'll carry your pack even further, you'd end up with this ridiculous scene of a soldier chasing a peasant down the road, begging him to stop so that he could carry his own pack. Again, embarrassing. And if things like that kept happening, word will get out and maybe the poor will be treated with more respect. This is clever, non-violent resistance. And when Jesus taught this, the crowd of thousands who were there on the edge of the Sea of Galilee listening, most of whom were peasants, would have been laughing and cheering. The sermon would have challenged them and provoked them and encouraged them and got them thinking and got them laughing all at the same time. So Jesus is the great teacher. Few people disagree with that. Jesus is this great teacher. But what is often missed is that quite a lot of Jesus' teaching is about himself. He loved talking about himself. You can't just say he's a great ethicist or a philosopher or a religious sage, because the actual stuff that he says, if you actually look at it, doesn't let you do that. Look at some of the things he says just in John's Gospel. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the light of the world. I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry again. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. If anybody else who was supposedly a great teacher spoke this way, you'd say they were either crazy or very arrogant. Lots of what Jesus says is telling people, in a way that was particular to that culture, that he's not just a special person, although he is, but he's God come to earth. He's both a man and he's God at the same time. What an unbelievable idea. What a claim. And in light of this, amazingly, Jesus speaks with absolute certainty and conviction in everything. But unlike any other teacher you care to mention, Jesus somehow manages to be very loving and serve other people and be incredibly wise, and yet at the same time be very clear about his own sense of his own importance. He manages to do all those things at the same time. Nobody has ever taught like Jesus. Second thing, nobody performed miracles like him. Nobody performed miracles like him. Now, if you read the accounts of Jesus' life, the four Gospels, Jesus performs quite a number of miracles. And naturally, our 21st century enlightened minds will say, whoa, 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 hold on. Great teacher. Yeah, I can get on board with that. But miracles? Really? That sounds quite hard to believe. But consider this. Firstly, people who didn't like Jesus didn't deny that he did miracles. His enemies didn't deny it. You see this repeatedly with the religious leaders he meets in the Gospels. Our questions around miracles are along the lines of, well, did that really happen? Really? Come on. But Jesus' enemies weren't asking that. They weren't contesting that. Their concern was, hold on, where did you get the power for this? We didn't approve this miracle. What are you doing? This would have come up in a board meeting, Jesus. Why have you not asked for permission? Where did you get the authority for this? So even his enemies didn't deny that he did miracles. Secondly, you may not know this, but sources outside the Bible also note that Jesus did miraculous things. For example, the Roman historian Josephus and the Jewish Babylonian Talmud, neither of which have any reason to be pro-Jesus, both confirm that Jesus was known to do supernatural things. In fact, the Talmud, which is a Jewish source of literature, actually accuses him of sorcery for lack of any other explanation. They had nothing else to say. Thirdly, everyone, every historian agrees that Jesus drew crowds in their thousands. As I said before, religious leaders were commonplace in first century Israel. There were loads of them, but nobody drew a crowd like Jesus. What was the difference? Yes, he was the best teacher, but people also knew he did miracles. He healed people. That will always, always draw a crowd. And Jesus did like nobody else. And fourth thought, if God was to come into our world as a human, obviously people would struggle to believe it. You may even be one of those people. But perhaps the best way for God to demonstrate who he is would be to do things that no ordinary person could do. And the thing is, while many people did believe in Jesus, in part because of the miracles, there were also people who saw them up close that still struggled to believe him. Which suggests it's not just about whether you see a miracle or not personally. There is more going on in whether or not you believe in Jesus. How open are we to the possibility that he really is this particularly special person? My favorite healing story of Jesus is also Matthew's Gospel, chapter 8. It's in Luke's Gospel too, actually. And it goes like this. Large crowds followed Jesus as he came down the mountainside. Suddenly, a man with leprosy approached him and knelt before him. Lord, the man said, if you are willing, you can heal me and make me clean. Jesus reached out and touched him. I am willing, he said, be healed. And instantly, the leprosy disappeared. Then Jesus said to him, don't tell anyone about this. Instead, go to the priest and let him examine you. Take along the offering required in the law of Moses for those who have been healed of leprosy. This will be a public testimony that you've been cleansed. Now, leprosy at that time was not quite the same as what we call leprosy now, but it was awful. You had to live in a special leper colony away from your family. Nobody could touch you. Literally, your body would crumble away. People lost fingers and toes and eventually more. It was awful. And it was generally believed that if you had leprosy, it must have been your own fault. You must have done some terrible thing and God was punishing you. That was what everyone believed. You wouldn't go near a leper ever. And then Jesus shows up. Jesus has no problem with touching this man. Anyone watching would have gasped in shock. But where religion means if you touch something unclean, you get unclean. With Jesus, if he touches something unclean, it gets clean, it gets fixed. He is that powerful. So this man gets healed. And remember, this is not being healed from a vague headache. This is leprosy. It's visible. It can be checked. But Jesus still says to the man, keep this to yourself. And Jesus does this a lot in his early ministry, which is another amazing thing about him. Most people in history who have claimed to do miracles want to show off. They want the world to know. They want to be on TV and get interviewed by Graham Norton. That's what they're after. Jesus has the power, but he's in no rush. It's not the right time. Something is more important to him than fame. Even the miracles are not the main event. But also know what happens next. Jesus tells the man, go and be examined by the priest. It doesn't sound very exciting, does it? But basically, this was the equivalent of going to the doctor to have it confirmed. It's like getting discharged from hospital. And this tells us something about Jesus too. He's not just about the spectacular physical healing. He's about the whole person. Once this now ex-leper goes to the priest and he follows all the cultural regulations, he's able to re-enter society. He can go back to his family. He can live life again. And that is what Jesus wants for him. Nobody performed miracles like Jesus in the way that Jesus did. Third thing, nobody fulfilled prophecy like him. Nobody fulfilled prophecy like him. You may not know this. The Old Testament, all written long before Jesus was born, was full of promises about a Messiah, a savior figure who would show up and sort everything out. And it's a bit like if you're watching a great film and it's all set up for the last third of the film where the hero suddenly arrives and then everything's okay. And we live in a time and a place where people don't generally look at the Old Testament, aren't generally familiar with it. Even many Christians don't look at it very often. But for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, the people of Israel were waiting and looking forward to this Messiah figure showing up. They didn't know exactly what he would do, but they knew it would be good. And it's great with hindsight from where we are to look at the Old Testament and go, oh yeah, that's a Jesus thing. That's really clever. And there's a number of points where it makes a prophecy, a prediction about this Messiah figure that we then see Jesus fulfill it. Here are three of my favorite examples, prophecies made long before Jesus was born. Firstly, the tiny Old Testament book of Micah was written to reassure the people they were going to get invaded by the Assyrians. And Micah says, no, don't worry about it. Assyria won't win, which they didn't. But he also looks forward. And in Micah 5, chapter 2, he says this, but you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, are only a small village among all the people of Judah. Yet a ruler of Israel, whose origins are in the distant past, will come from you on my behalf. So Micah says, this ruler, whose origins are in the distant past, in other words, he pre-exists the world, that's quite a big thing to say, this ruler will come from Bethlehem. It's going to be in the future, he's going to come from Bethlehem. Now you would think someone making a big prediction like this would hedge their bets, wouldn't you? You'd think, well, this great leader will come from somewhere in the vicinity of London. Because then, you know, you've got a decent chance of a great leader coming from that sort of area because it's the biggest city. But Bethlehem was tiny. The equivalent would be if Micah had said, this great leader of the nation will come from Rustington. Oh, okay. And just to be really clear, there were a number of places in Israel called Bethlehem at the time. There was about five or six of them. So Micah's really specific. It's Bethlehem Ephrathah. It's that particular Bethlehem. And where was Jesus born according to every historical source? Bethlehem, Ephrathah, that particular one. Next, Daniel, another Old Testament book, in chapter 9, written maybe 600 years before Jesus was born, looks forward to the future and it says this, and bear with me, this sounds weird. Now listen and understand. Seven sets of seven plus 62 sets of seven, who's adding it up, will pass from the time the command is given to rebuild Jerusalem until a ruler, the anointed one, comes. Jerusalem will be rebuilt with streets and strong defences despite the perilous times. After this period of 62 sets of seven, the anointed one will be killed, appearing to have accomplished nothing. And a ruler will arise whose armies will destroy the city and the temple. Now, it's written in a bit of a weird way, isn't it? With all these sets of seven. But basically, if you do the maths, the command to rebuild Jerusalem was given by the Persian ruler Artaxerxes, had this whole empire, in about 440, not about, exactly, I should say, because this is important, in exactly 444 BC. At that time, Israel was subject to his rule. But if you use the Jewish calendar, which is 360 days, not our calendar, which obviously is 365, if you use the Jewish calendar, it brings you to a prediction that this anointed one, this Messiah, would be killed in what, from our point of view, is 33 AD. Isn't that mad? Which brings us to one of the very small possible number of possible years, of course, where Jesus was crucified. We know for a fact that the city and the temple were destroyed by the Romans in AD 70, not long after. In other words, to summarize this, the Old Testament tells us far ahead, hundreds of years ahead, when this Messiah will die, and it's slap bang in the middle of the very short period when we know that Jesus died. Isn't that amazing? Last one. This is Isaiah chapter 53, written about 800 years before Jesus was born, and it says this. He was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with deepest grief. We turned our backs on him and looked the other way. He was despised and we did not care. Yet it was our weaknesses he carried. It was our sorrows that weighed him down. And we thought his troubles were a punishment from God, a punishment for his own sins. But he was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. He was beaten so we could be whole. He was whipped so we could be healed. All of us like sheep have strayed away. We've left God's path to follow our own. Yet the Lord laid on him the sins of us all. This is just one small portion, but if you read all of Isaiah 53 and 54, it describes everything that happened to Jesus long before it did. It tells us why it happened. But Isaiah's very vivid description of Jesus' trial and how he died sounds very much like a crucifixion. And it was written years before the Romans had even invented crucifixion as a method of execution. 800 years before Jesus' trial, the whole ordeal, all the way up to his execution, is described. So the Old Testament, years before, tells us where this special Messiah figure will be born. It tells us when he will die and how and why. And these are just some of the Old Testament predictions. There are loads of them. And some of them, to be fair, you could say, well, you know, Jesus could have read that and then he could have gone and done it. You know, he could have just read about it and then gone and done it. But it's not normally possible to choose where you're born, in what era, and how you'll die, especially if the method of death is something you can't physically do to yourself anyway, like crucifixion. And I have to tell you, I've spent time in the Middle East, I've read books on this stuff, I haven't heard an even vaguely convincing counter-argument to this. Either the predictions of the Old Testament are true, because Jesus is exactly who he said he is, and it's all part of God's plan, or we have the greatest set of coincidences that has ever come together in the history of the world by an absolutely enormous margin. It is one or the other. Next, nobody changed the world like him. Jesus is the most influential person who has ever lived. Considering that he came from nowhere important, he was from a family that wasn't important, he only lived to 33, and he had a public ministry that only lasted about 3 or 4 years, that's absolutely insane. That shouldn't happen. But loads of things that we take for granted, loads of things that we assume to be good, originate with Jesus and his teaching and what his followers taught when they reflected on his life. Just think, things that, as I said, we take these things for granted. The equality of people, regardless of gender, race, age, and so on, originates with the New Testament. Human rights, so fashionable an idea and a great one, originates in the teaching of Jesus and the writing of his followers. The idea that being heroic isn't just about beating up the bad guys, but it's about self-sacrifice for others. That's the influence of Jesus. The movement towards literacy around the world. Thousands of obscure languages have been saved by Christian Bible translators who've sought to democratize language. Plus, whole languages have been systematized in a way that has kept nations together because people wanted other people to know about Jesus. The invention of universities as a place of deep learning. That was clergy who followed Jesus in the Middle Ages. The idea that truth is objective, the universe is rational, and therefore we can do scientific research sensibly, goes back to Jesus. The idea of compassion to someone regardless of status. In the ancient world, it was common for unwanted babies to be left in the rubbish in the street until Christians started picking them up and looking after them, even though people objected and thought it was distasteful. And the world has now changed, thankfully, that to do such a thing would be seen as shocking. It's rooted in the teaching of Jesus. The development of hospitals originated through monks who followed Jesus. Followers of Jesus led the charge on abolishing slavery, transforming civil rights in America, and ending widow burning in India. Every year, 150,000 people are put to death around the world for following Jesus. His influence is so great, they would rather die than renounce following him. Last year, this book came out, Dominion by Tom Holland. That's Tom Holland, the eminent historian, not Tom Holland, the actor who plays Spider-Man. Holland isn't a Christian himself, but the book represents years of research by a top historian into how Christianity, and therefore Jesus, has influenced Western culture. And he says that basically, the way that we think as Western people is so ingrained, we just can't even see it. Like a fish doesn't realize that it's in water. It doesn't know anything else. And so much that's good about our culture, the benefits of it that we feel, are rooted in the life of Jesus, whether we acknowledge it or root it or not. The author, Dr. James A. Francis, who wrote about Jesus, put it very nicely. He said, "I am far within the mark when they say that all the armies that have ever marched, all the navies that were ever built, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned, put together, have not affected the life of man upon this earth as powerfully as has that one solitary life." Blows everybody else away. Fifth and final thought. Nobody came back from the dead like him. It's a bigger subject than we have for now, but briefly, very briefly, you might be surprised at how strong the case is for the literal bodily resurrection of Jesus as a historical fact. Certainly nobody denies all his early followers, people that knew him really well, believed that it had happened because they spent the rest of their lives talking about it, even to the point where they were also executed for doing so. The explosion of Christianity in the first few centuries has no explanation other than that people believed that they had seen the resurrected Jesus. And it's quite hard to write them off and go, oh, well, they're just uneducated first century people, because first century Jews were about as likely to believe in a resurrection as we are. Within their worldview, it didn't happen. But people did believe in their droves. And there is no other good explanation for why that happened. So this is why Jesus is special. Nobody taught like him. Nobody did miracles like him. Nobody fulfilled prophecy like him. No one has influenced the world like him. And nobody has come back from the dead like him. But I also have to say, nobody is for you right now like him. Nobody is for you like him. All the stuff I've said about Jesus can make him seem amazing, yes, intriguing, yes, but maybe sort of otherworldly and distant. How do you interact with somebody like this, even if it is real? I'm going to talk about this a bit more next week. Next week is all about the question of how could God be interested in me as an individual? But one more way that Jesus elevates himself above everybody else is that he's for us in a way that nobody else is. Jesus is relentlessly impressive in intellect and power and wisdom and in compassion. And yet the whole point of Jesus' life and death and resurrection is to be the love of God made real, made tangible, made knowable to every person on earth, to every one of us. It's very easy to play intellectual games with Jesus. More books have been written about him than anyone. More paintings painted. More symphonies written. He's fascinating. But everything about him speaks of God's pursuit of us. And to some extent puts the ball in our court. And if you're not a Christian today, Everything about Jesus speaks to you in a way that is basically unavoidable. It's personal and uncomfortable, and you fear having to change, and you fear being let down because that's what a lot of other people have done in life. But Jesus stands not only over history, he stands next to you personally. He wants good for you. He wants you to know God in a personal way. He's the route to making that happen. One of the reasons we exist as a church is to give the opportunity to explore that to anybody who wants to. If you're a Christian this morning, the same is true, of course. And if you are a Christian and you've been one for a while, it might be that I haven't said anything now that you've not heard before. That's okay. My aim this morning was not to be original, but rather we all need sometimes the explicit reminder that Jesus is uniquely special. He's uniquely God come to earth, and he's uniquely for us. And so I don't have any big application points, because on this topic, all I think we should do is worship in appreciation and be glad, because Jesus is for us like nobody else.